You're listening to a resource from the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to promote excellence in biblical counseling. For more resources or to find out more information about ACBC, please visit us at biblicalcounseling.com.
Today, we are going to be looking, really doing two main things and potentially a third. However, if you guys have questions, I'd love to avoid the third and really spend the time answering your questions. We're going to discuss a doctrine of emotions. And I think this is really important, because if we start by assuming that we're all on the same page and have the same understanding when we're talking about emotions, we've already failed. But literally, we all do that. We use words like anger and happiness and things like that. And we all assume that as I discuss that, you know what I'm talking about. But you really don't. And I don't really know what you're talking about when you're talking about anger. And this is why we have so many discrepancies. So we're going to start with what I call the doctrine of emotions. A lot of it's information you'll be familiar with, and we will get through it kind of quickly. But if you say, wow, this is new, or I'd like to learn some more about this, I've got some resources for you. And then we're going to look at the five failures of emotion coaching. Just put it out there right away that, yes, we're going to be discussing the critiques, the criticisms, the five failures. Originally, I had gone through this book that Gottman wrote, Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child, and I had just gone through and done a chapter-by-chapter critique of the big ideas, and then I was like, okay, that's way too much information. So in the notes that was provided through ACBC, there's actually a ton of extra stuff at the end where I have some thoughts, some sketched outlined thoughts about different things throughout the chapter. So if you wanted to see that as a little bit more of a deep dive into the book, you could definitely do that. But we probably won't get into too much of that unless I fly through this material and have tons of time left. So I want to start with the doctrine of emotions, and this QR code right here, what it'll do is if you use your phone, you can, it'll take you to a web page where you'll be able to create a free login for the Evermind app. The Evermind app is where all of our curriculum and courses and stuff like that are. When you put in, you create your own unique login, and you get in there, you'll then have the opportunity to download the app. You don't even have to download the app. You can just access it online. But you can download the app, and then when you open it up under the Learn tab, you will have access to the Doctrine of Emotion, one of our courses. You'll see other things on there, podcasts that I've done, so on and so forth. But this QR code will be up there throughout a good portion of this discussion. So if at any time, you can take a picture of that and get back to it later, because I know we don't have fantastic internet in here right now. But within the Doctrine of Emotions, I like to talk about three big ideas: emotional discrepancies, emotional descriptions, and emotional dysfunctions. And so we're going to start with the emotional discrepancies, and we're going to see that our world has some significant issues in how we understand emotions. We're going to look at the problem before we're going to look at the solution. And I want to start with our vocabulary. Think about this, my friends. How the word feel is used as a word in our English vocabulary. It's used oftentimes to describe what we would call feelings, and as different from emotions. So for example, I feel sore, I feel sick, I feel cold, I feel tired. These for the most part are physical feelings that we have outside of ourselves, sometimes part of ourselves, but it's still something that we would attach to a really physiological concept. But then we use the word feel to discuss emotions, things that tend to be a little bit more esoteric. I feel happy, I feel sad, I feel afraid. And so already right there, we see that, you know, these things have a relationship to them, but they also have a very big distinction between the two. However, we also use the word feel in a very religious concept. I feel like God is talking to me. I feel the Holy Spirit's presence. I feel the peace of God, which some people will say that because they think that peace of God is an emotion. Those of us who know that it's not emotion still hear that terminology, though. I feel the peace of God. And then this is the one that gets me a lot. If you're talking to me later today and you find yourself saying it, you just know that I'm judging you, all right? Just in the back of my head, that little piece of me going, stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it. We've exchanged the word think for the word feel. I feel like you're mad at me. I feel like this isn't the best decision. I feel like there's another way. No, you don't. You think those things. You believe those things. You might know those things, but you actually don't feel those things. But this is what we've created in our culture, where the word feel has all these different meanings. Thomas Sowell, some of you are familiar with him, is a philosopher and a political analyst. And he said this, the problem isn't that Johnny can't read. The problem isn't even that Johnny can't think. The problem is that Johnny doesn't know what thinking is. He confuses it with feeling. Whew. And then we see movies like Inside Out come out. Cute movie, gets all the feels going, right? Gets the tears going. I like the movie in lots of ways, aside from the fact that the basic foundation of the fact that everything we say and do is controlled by our feelings is 100% wrong, but that's how the world thinks it works. And so we have a lot of discrepancies when it comes to our vocabulary and how we even discuss this. So again, this adds to the confusion of the fact that we are really not all on the same page when it comes to our feelings. So whatever our vocabulary consistently tells us constitutes the most integral parts of our existence. Whatever our vocabulary tells us constitutes the most integral part of our existence, that will become the single most concept in our lives. And so a feeling is used to describe everything, what becomes the most important thing in my life? Feelings. Right, so this is the world that we live in. Let's talk about discrepancies in perception. Here, I'm just going to throw these up right away. We'll go through them one by one. Only you can know your feelings, which is funny because we all assume that, you know, you understand what I'm saying when I talk about my feelings, and so therefore, you know, I understand, you know, right? We all kind of feel that way, don't we? But only you can know your feelings. In addition to that, only you can accurately interpret your feelings. See, nobody else can tell you how you feel, right? You will, and here's the real dangerous one. You will always accurately interpret your feelings. So if somebody were to disagree with you, well, they can't do that. They obviously don't possess the ability of that, because I'm the only person who really knows how I feel. And since I'm always accurately interpreting my feelings, I'm right and you've got nothing to say to me. But then in addition to that, as we kind of discussed earlier, feelings are reality. This is all that really matters. This is how I live my life, make my decisions. And therefore, feelings are more important than anything else. These are the perception that many people have about their emotions, about their feelings. This is the book that we'll be critiquing in a few minutes. Has that basic concept wrapped up in it. This is the most important part of parenting. In fact, the subtitle of the book is, Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child, The Heart of Parenting. For he believes it's at the core. Your ability to parent well is going to be tied to understanding how the emotions work. So we have a discrepancy in vocabulary, a discrepancy in perception, but we also have a discrepancy in authority. And this one flows really well from the last one. Who gets to decide how important emotions are? Actually, I jumped to the last one. Who gets to decide what emotions mean? Well, in our world, obviously the answer is me, not you. And the funny thing is that even though we don't know how the other, supposedly we don't know how the other people are feeling and all other kind of stuff, what I believe about emotions is obviously right for me and for you. And what you believe about emotions is right for you, and I need to also shut up and listen to you, and oh man. Who gets to decide the purpose of emotions, and who gets to decide how important emotions are? This question of authority, this discrepancy in who gets to make these decisions also is a big part of the discrepancies, what I call the emotional discrepancies that we see in the world today. And so even though Voltaire is not somebody who really has a lot to speak valuable into religious conversations and it's things in nature talking about the scriptures, he does have something really valuable to say. If you're going to converse with me, define your terms. And we need to do that as biblical counselors. We need to get on the same page. And we must stop assuming that our counselees, whoever they may be, friends, official counselees, formal counselees, I should say, our children, whatever, we have to stop assuming that they know what I mean just because I said it. And we need to ask questions. But because everyone comes to the standpoint that when your counselee sits down and says, I feel sad, then you're just like, well, I know that she feels sad. Now there are a bunch of other questions I want to ask. What you need to figure out is what exactly does she even mean by that? Really, what does she mean by that? Because it may surprise you that her definition of feeling sad is not the same as yours. Now we want to move to emotional descriptions. And we're going to start by looking at a secular description. We're going to look at a biblical description, and then we're going to come up with what I call a biblically accurate scientific description. I wanted to keep biblical and scientific in there, even though technically all science, true science, is biblical and God's, you know, it's all there. But I wanted to get it there so that we recognize the fact that this is the big picture of what emotions really are. So we're going to start with a secular description. If you look it up, you basically find that secular description of emotions breaks down into three things, okay? There is a subjective experience. That experience oftentimes is an external one that when you read the literature. Then there is an internal physiological response followed by an external behavior. Let me give you a perfect example of this. Okay, what was the external stimulus? This. What was the physiological response? What was the external behavior? Laughing, movement, looking up, you know, all of that. See, here, we just experienced an emotion. Congratulations. However, there's a lot missing from what just happened. Something desperately important missing from what just happened. And I would guess that if we're not careful, most of us and all of our counselees don't realize what just happened. And they're going to define their experience off of a misconception because they don't fully, robustly understand what emotions are, why they were designed, and what they do for us. I'd say I'm sorry, but I'm not. I love doing that illustration.
Look up the emotion of anger.
Yeah, it's, some people are like, what's he doing? These whippersnappers these days. Yeah. My heart. Yeah. We're going to start with, now we're looking at a biblical description, okay? And I wish I could take more time with this. This is where the resources are going to be really valuable for you. I've gone so many different places. I have a number of different interviews I've done on different shows. I have some different podcast episodes that I've done. We're building out this topic of emotions because it is such a huge deal. We're going to dig into them in more and more detail. But if you go to that app, you'll see that each of these things I'm about to talk about, I talk about in more detail. I'm glad that wasn't in here. He or she. That was the little one, boy or girl. I'm glad she was not in here a minute ago. That was God's providence. I just did something super, that would have woken her up. She would not have liked it. Your timing was perfect. But these three things are going into more detail in the app. First of all, emotions are a gift, okay? God did not create us to be rocks, robots, Vulcans. He created us to be able to have this really robust, I just found all the Trekkies in the room. To really robust, dynamic experience in life that we can laugh, we can be filled with lots of different feelings. Emotions are a gift. And in the extra resources, I go into more information about that. It's not just a gift to the individual. It's also a gift to the body. You know, we've been called by God, commanded by God to weep with those who weep, rejoice with those who rejoice. There is it's a gift. I can come alongside you, you can come alongside me, and in an emotional way can be a gift to each other, which is a really beautiful thing. But it's also a gift to authorities, and I would say it's a gift to counselors. Okay, in a moment, we're going to talk about it a little bit more. The next point, which is a tool, and I think most of us, a tool in the gauge, are familiar with those concepts. But as a counselor, how my counselee is feeling is a very valuable tool for me to know how best to help them. Again, whether it's my child or a friend or whoever it may be. So emotions are a gift for lots of different reasons. They're also a tool, though. See, 1 Corinthians 10:31 tells us, whether therefore you eat or drink or whatsoever you do, we could insert feel stuff, do all to the glory of God. That means that God has given us emotions for the greatest purpose that mankind is on this earth, to know God and to glorify Him for all eternity. Our emotions have to do that. They are not... In a sense, and we'll get into the details of this, emotions, in a sense, can be an amoral concept. Emotions, what I'll call a pure emotions, aren't a sin. But what we're talking about when we're talking about emotions can be. They can be a sin. And so, therefore, we need to make certain that we are glorifying God with our emotions by experiencing emotions that that would please Him. It just dawned on me that when I hit that, all those people over there had no idea why I did that. And last one, emotions are a gauge. You've likely heard this before. Rebecca Hanna, who's spoken for ACBC before, says that emotions are a gauge, not a guide. And it's the same thing with a smoke detector in your house. They're there. It's there to warn you. It can be there to warn you of a problem. They can help you see when there's a spiritual issue in your life. So, for example, if God says that something should cause us to be happy, and I'm sad when I encounter that, that should be a warning sign that something's wrong. If God says that something should cause me to feel sad and I feel happy about it, that should be a warning to me that something is wrong. And so these are the three, as you search the scriptures, again, we're not building this out robustly because we do want to get to the critique of the work. These are the three main things that we see in scripture that God has given us that kind of fill out the doctrine of emotions. They're a gift, a tool, and they are a gauge. I'm going to stop just for, because I know I went through that quickly. I didn't even go through all of the notes that I have here. I want to see if there are any questions about that, because I don't want to move on if there is a question about how this functions. Yes, sir.
Just you said something was left out, but you're going to tell us what was left out when we get further? Under the secular description, you said they had these three, but I think I heard you say.
Yes, that's the next point. That's the next. Yes, sir. Yep. We're going to look at that next, as long as we understand this. Okay, cool. So let's look at a biblically accurate scientific description, which will include the secular description that we just saw with biblical reality mixed in, okay? So I'm just going to put them all up there. There is an external or internal subjective experience. I'll explain the internal in a second. We have the internal physiological response. This is what I call the pure emotion, okay? The physiological, the chemical that goes through your body. When I hit this table, you all had a shared chemical experience, which sounds really terrible. Don't let that get outside of this room. You all experienced what? What was the chemical you experienced?
Adrenaline,
yeah. This is where my story from last night comes in. I was ready for bed. I was actually in bed and in the hotel last night, and I hear some elevated voices coming down the hall. I'm sitting there and I'm listening, and apparently a man is yelling at a woman because, according to him, she had illegally gone into his room, taken his things, and lifted a hand against his dog. And I'm like, okay, accusations. But then they didn't stop. I mean, this guy, he was practiced. Like, part of me was wondering whether or not this was a situation where he just like learn this subconsciously or whether he was doing it on purpose, because he was, and I'm not going to be as annoying as he was, but he said, you came in my room, you came in my room, you came in my room, you came in, and he just would go. And then it was like, and you took my things, you took my things, you took my things. And he was just oppressive. And I'm like, so clothes back on, walk outside the door, introduced myself into the situation, and was the recipient of his vitriol. Now, I got to be part of that. I got to share in the experience, which, by the way, this is the second time I've gone to an ACBC conference and got pulled into a something like this ride to give testimony to a police officer. I'm blaming ACBC. I think that's probably the issue. Anyway, so in that situation, this guy found another, I mean, and by the way, all of the words you could possibly imagine or not want to imagine. His vocabulary was exceptionally robust in all of the worst ways, and he was flinging it at everyone. My goal, just so you understand, my goal was there to really to just to be able to intervene and to protect. As a martial artist of over 30 years, I wanted to make certain that nobody was physically harmed. And as long as he was going to be a jerk and run his mouth, that's fine. I was going to be there as long as anybody needed that type of protection. And thankfully, it didn't go to that. At some point, somebody had said that earlier before I got in, there had been a physical altercation, but it didn't get there, thankfully, while I was there. But so at one point, he's railing on me. Apparently, I'm a liberal, because I guess maybe that's what I am. I don't know. I wasn't even saying that much, but my being there meant that I was, you know, whatever. None of it really made sense. But at one point, my lips started to quiver. Oh, boy. What did he think? What did he think? I was scared of him. Oh, boy, that was exciting for him, right? Because that whole new set of things that he could throw at me. Right? And as this progressed, what else started to happen? To me.
Turban?
I don't know. Potentially.
Did you sweat?
No, it was this. It was this, and then it was this, and then it was like, it's this, right? So it's, you know, what is this? Well, it could be the fear. It could be like the rage. But the entire time I'm talking to him, I'm actually talking to him more even keeled than I am to you. I'm raising my voice to be heard. But, and this is just a very conversational thing, and being not using caustic language, it's all very controlled here. But like from the bottom lip down, it was like, and you know, then, so afterward, it was all finished up and the police left. I'm in my room doing push-ups because I know that I'm not going to fall asleep tonight if I don't get this out of my system. The internal physiological response was adrenaline. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now this is where things get tricky. This is where the world doesn't get it. There is an internal spiritual response. Mental, spiritual, same thing, right? Wherein we interpret what's going on. I wish I had time to go into all the stuff here. By the way, do you guys see this? How many of you didn't like this when you saw it? It's a joke! It's a joke! For those of you who are listening to this at some other time, I wrote on the board, the average person is mean. Get it? No, really, do you get it? Average, mean. Okay, anyway. Interpretation is everything. He interpreted what I was experiencing as being fear or anger, but I wasn't experiencing fear. I wasn't afraid. I wasn't angry. I had adrenaline coursing through my system. Here's the problem, and this is me now talking to a bunch of parents. I'm my parenting conferences. Stop lying to your children. They're not afraid. They're experiencing a gift from God, a tool called adrenaline that God gave their bodies to heighten their senses and to help them do what they need to do in fight or flight situations. They're not afraid. As a speech teacher, I teach people improv, I teach people acting. Mr. Brewster, I have stage fright. No, you don't. Stop lying to yourself. You have adrenaline. I have adrenaline. I'm experiencing it right now. But I'm using that adrenaline to raise my voice, to focus my mind, to have all the things I need to do to keep you guys awake after lunch, right? All of that is there. It's a tool that I'm using in this life. It's not fear. Here's the interesting thing. The main chemical reaction, the main internal physiological response, the main pure emotion, adrenaline, is nearly identical in situations of sexual attraction, exhilaration, anger, and fear. It's not like there are four different type of chemical responses going on in our body. Oh, that's such and such. I'm angry. Oh, that's adrenaline. I'm this. No, it's all the same chemical interpreted differently. Two people on the same roller coaster. One person is freaking out, wants to die, scared out of their mind. The other person, loving it. Same pure emotional response. Same physiological experience. Two different interpretations. This is where we miss it. This is where we fall apart in our understanding of emotions, because we think that emotions are what we feel. They're not. Your emotion is what you think about what you feel. That is the key. It's what you think. It's what your counselee thinks about what they feel. A minute ago, most of you would have described yourself as either afraid or angry at what I did when I slammed on the table. But you weren't afraid. You're only afraid because you told yourself you were, because you've come to believe that that feeling equals fear. But it doesn't. And if you're honest with yourself, you're inconsistent in your defining, because there are times that you have those same adrenaline responses that you don't call it fear, you call it something else, because in that moment you're interpreting it differently because of the situation. So this is huge. I'm getting into the weeds. I could spend forever on this point. That then leads to an external behavior, which then additionally can loop back on itself. What's interesting is that a situation occurs, right? Slam on the table, spider walks into the room, guy being whatever, right? There's that initial physiological response, the adrenaline rush or whatever. But then oftentimes our response grows, it multiplies. Why? Because of how we continue to think about it. The situation hasn't changed. It's no more scary than it was. It's no more intense than it was. But as I've dwelt on it, sometimes days later, I'm getting more and more angry because of my meditating on it. And so this just feeds back around to the beginning, becomes this first point, and we just keep continually cycling through. So when we're dealing, and this is where we kind of need to move forward. When we're dealing with somebody in a question of emotions, what we need to really figure out is what they believe about what they're experiencing. That is the key. Yes, you've just described an experience, but my friend, millions of people have had that experience and most of them have responded differently than you. The experience isn't the thing. Yes, you had a chemical response in your body. Lots of people have those same chemical responses in their body and they respond differently than you. That's not the thing. What do you think about this situation? What do you believe about what you're experiencing? What do you believe about what you're feeling right now is the thing. Having worked at a boys' home for at-risk teens, some of you probably saw Victory Academy for Boys in the bookstore. Great ministry, worked there for 5 years. We had all the emotions, all the feels running all the time. Anger was one of the big ones that we dealt with quite frequently. And every guy who ever melted down, and we had some doozies, they all changed. They all settled down at the exact same point. The exact same thing triggered all of them to calm down. And it was the moment that they acknowledged reality. The moment that they looked at the situation biblically, accurately, from a real perspective, they couldn't be angry anymore. One example that I use is a boy at recess throwing acorns playfully at his schoolmates. Genuinely playfully, not being mean or unkind. They're like, okay, and they start throwing acorns back at him and each other. Right? Let's get in on the game. And these are high schoolers, okay? These aren't little kids. And like the first time he's having fun as long as he's not getting hit. The first time he gets hit with an acorn, nuclear. When it was hours of screaming and rage and actually it was probably an hour or so before I got there, another 45 minutes or so before he finally cooled down. But it was like, he had to come, because in his mind, he had lied to himself about the situation. They hate me. They're always picking on me. They're throwing acorns at me. It's like, dude, you were doing it, and were you mad at them? No. They were just doing it back, having a good time. No, they weren't. They were. Okay, well, how do you know that? But I mean, all of the things until finally he realizes how stupid he was. Finally, he realizes how his decisions have brought him to this place and all the consequences he's going to receive. And now he's like, oh. Complete change because of how he perceived the situation. We've got to get them to that place. And so really when it comes down to the issues that your counselors are struggling with, I put it this way, and to be completely honest, I hate the first description. I need to come up with a different word for it, but it's pretty accurate. The emotional dysfunctions, that's not the part I hate. The part I hate is the emotional illness. It kind of sounds like mental illness, but emotional illness actually makes sense because emotions, pure emotions, that is, are actually chemical things in our bodies. There are drugs you can take that mess with the chemicals in your bodies. By the way, somebody asked me about this recently. What I'm saying could sound dangerously close to the chemical imbalance theory. It's not. Okay. The chemical imbalance theory is audacious and arrogant enough to suggest that they know what the balance is, but the reality is we don't. We can't measure that. We don't know what anybody's balance is. Not any chemical balance. It's just how God created our bodies to work. When I hit the table, you didn't have a chemical imbalance. You had a chemical, and you had exactly what God intended for your body to have. It's not that you're imbalanced. It's just that you needed to know how to respond to it. That's all. So don't think that I'm going in the chemical imbalance theory, but there are illnesses that you can have, physical illnesses. For example, I've had a fungal infection called Candida, which one of the side effects of a large Candida bloom is that you can have what feels like anxiety. You can have that feeling in your chest. Those of us who experienced the COVID depression, I'm not sure if any of you guys did that. I got there. I experienced that where I was having to self-counsel because I was feeling depressed but having then to interpret the situation correctly, keeping my mind on truth, even though I felt like this. So there are things that you can have, certain diseases and cancers, and then the drugs that they give you, it can mess with the chemicals in your body. So we always want to make certain, as you know, that our counselees are healthy, okay? That they aren't experiencing something that would be producing a pure emotion, a chemical response in their body that they're interpreting as something that it's not. So, like, for example, candida is one of those things that most people don't really know too much about and that a lot of people struggle with. And because the larger fungal blooms in the body can produce this big, significant feelings of anxiety, I'm touching my mic, people will go looking for help from doctors, from counselors, whatever else, because they're feeling so anxious. And now they're in the weeds talking about stuff that has nothing to do with it. Let's just get your fungal infection under control and you'll feel fine. Right now, of course, even in those situations, we as biblical counselors have the responsibility to help them learn to glorify God in that scenario. We don't sin in our anxiety because you're feeling a pure emotional anxiety experience. So there's that. There's emotional illness, which can sometimes be there. However, emotional interpretation is normally the big one. This is the one that most of our counselees, this is the one that we, our kids, are struggling with most of the time. We're just wrongly interpreting the experience, and we're wrongly interpreting what we're feeling about the experience or the chemical reactions that are being brought up because of the experience. Emotional incongruity basically is what we talked about earlier, where I should be feeling one thing, but I'm feeling another. Sometimes that's part of it. That's oftentimes tied to and grows from the emotional interpretation issues because I'm interpreting the situation incorrectly. So for example, you know, that guy last night, I mean, he was hyped up, right? He had the adrenaline going through him. He was buzzed, right? Because he was into this. He had a sense of exhilaration because of what he was doing. You could tell. Should he have been experiencing that? No, he should have been under conviction. He should have been feeling lots of bad things because of the terrible things that he was doing to this woman and to me and a bunch of other people. So that incongruity where my emotions are not lining up, my interpretation and my feelings are not lining up with reality is a problem that sometimes the counselee will be in. And then the emotional instability, again, by the way, I'm flying through this so quickly. I'll take some questions after this before we move to the next section because I want to make certain that we understand it. But again, the app has lots of resources where I talk about these things in grander detail. But the emotional instability is the one where whether it's a high emotion, like what we would call happiness or something like that, or a low emotion like depression, it just seems like it's more than we should be experiencing. It's bigger. It's worse. You know, my wife lost her grandfather a couple weeks ago. And, you know, some people lose a loved one and there's that expected amount of what we would think to be sadness and grief, right? But then there are people who just lose themselves in it. These tend to be the four big categories of the emotional, what I call dysfunctions. It was a D alliterated with the descriptions and the other ones I used earlier. But it really is. You can look at it that way. But these are the four ones that most of all of our emotional struggles will fall into these categories. Being able to identify which one it is a game changer in your counseling. Because if it's this and you're dealing with it like it's this, that's not super helpful. Again, you're getting into the weeds on that. Let's deal with the actual physical problem. However, I will say, in reality, this is a big part of all of them, okay? Because I get into these other areas because of an incorrect interpretation. Let me stop right there and ask if you have any clarifying questions or want some deeper insight into these four concepts before we transition and look at the five failures of emotion coaching. Awesome. We're all on the same page. Fantastic. Good. Okay.
And you say there's the app that we go to?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Yep. And when we're done here, we actually will have 30 minutes before the final session. That's 30 minutes before the bookstore will close, so you want to make sure you get over there if you haven't done that. But there will be some time. I want to open it up for questions at the end, and I can be here to hang out and answer questions at the end as well. So if you're having a hard time getting into the app or whatever, I can help you out with that. Okay, a little bit of a preface before we get into the five things. I do want to observe that Gottman, like many psychologists, anthropologists, and observant researchers, comes to certain valuable conclusions throughout the book. This particular book is no exception. However, regardless of any of the good points Gottman makes, I'll say right from the onset that emotion coaching is not a valuable system for Christians. Okay? Now, listen carefully to what I'm about to say so there's no misunderstanding. If there's anything I hate being misunderstood. I do love psychology. Secular psychology has great merit as an observational science, okay? Now, I'm not saying they get it all right all the time, but, you know, the colors of these rooms is due to observational psychological, you know, psychology, okay? Because we recognize that the colors and impacts that people has on people. But that leads me to number two. Psychology does not live up to its name, and we know this. Most of us know the word psychology means study of the soul. Biblically speaking, the human soul is an organic and spiritual unity between the human body and the human spirit. But since modern psychology denies the existence of the biblical spirit, it cannot fully comprehend the magnificent unity that is the soul and is therefore incapable of providing genuine answers for soul care. In regard to the study of the soul, it's only half a science because it disregards the spiritual realities of life. So with that, we need to understand that to the degree that Dr. Gottman or any other psychologist or psychiatrist ignores the teachings of scriptures, his system becomes more and more untrustworthy. And unfortunately, there's nothing about Dr. Gottman or his studies that leads me to believe he knows the Lord. Therefore, my blanket response to the question, should Christians utilize such and such a secular psychological model, is generally, if I'm being kind, in part. As I mentioned before, secular psychology can provide fantastic observations, though it can't be trusted every single time. People respond to various incentives, stimuli, pressures, and pleasures in observable ways, and modern psychology is a wealth of information in that vein. But the moment I break from psychology is when they try to provide answers for the soul's problems, methods and procedures and therapies and so on and so forth. And this is due to the fact that they only see half the problem. The secular psychiatrist rightly sees that their patient wants to commit suicide. Good on you. You figured that one out. They're able to hear that their patient blames his parents, his boss, his wife, and the world for being against him. That they hear his woes about depression and anxiety. They observe all of this, and then they start to come to conclusions. And this is where things go way, way, way off. And these conclusions are informed by a worldview that denies God. They believe their patient shouldn't commit suicide most of the time. And they agree with the patient that it definitely seems like he has a lot of stressors in his life. But since neither the doctor nor the patient are in a place to drastically affect all the stressors in his life, the average doctor is left with a couple options. Number one, try to convince his patient to respond to life stresses differently. Talk therapy. This tract involves, you know, that talk therapy, working toward emotional well-being, worldview transitions, things like that. But number two, medicate the patient against the emotional turmoil in the world so that they can focus on surviving. But neither of these guarantees any lasting success because they both deny God's truth on the subject. However, the biblical counselor observes all the same issues, hears all the same explanations, but the biblical counselor also has God's perfect insight into the heart issue that's inherent in the spirit of every man and every woman. This adds a supernaturally dynamic level of power, hope, and answers that the secular psychologist lacks. And this is exactly the same tension that I see in Dr. Gottman's work. I find it to be very beneficial in some limited regards, but so hazardous in others. In the end, it doesn't really matter how healthy a meal is. If the meal has poison in it, it's dangerous. Don't eat it. Gottman's system is dangerous because of significant fundamental flaws. So we're going to, with that, let's jump into the five failures. What I believe are the five biggest failures of emotion coaching, and we will go from there. All right, first of all, it's idolatrous. Any system that is not rooted in God and his word has got to be rooted in something else, and that something else is always man. So therefore, as you read through, and I'm not providing big quotations and things like that from his works, to a certain degree, you'll have to take my word on it or look later on in the notes. But he really ties this down to the individual, the family. Since this is written primarily as a parenting book, he talks about it a lot from the perspective of, you know, what we as a parent are trying to accomplish in our homes. Well, guess what? We shouldn't parent because of what we're trying to accomplish in our homes. We should parent the way we parent because God commands us to, and he deserves our obedience. That's why we parent the way we parent. Now, what I want to do, and I did say this at the outset, but I want this last section to both be an intellectual learning time so we can say that model's dangerous. Here's why. But beyond that, I also want to challenge us because it's so easy to look at the world and say they're doing that wrong and that wrong and that wrong and that wrong. But the reality is all the wrong they're doing, if we look closely enough, we can see in our own lives. All of our issues, all of our struggles, all of our sins are a result of idolatry. So emotion coaching, if somebody is being idolatrous and in sin, something that is rooted in idolatry isn't going to help. This is how I like to demonstrate it for people. I think when we talk about idolatry in the church, we've gotten a big misconception. All right? We picture an altar, we picture a thing on a pedestal, and we're bringing meat and stuff like that. We're offering it. Like, you know, we may say that money or our car or relationships or chocolate or sex, we're, you know, that's our idol. And so we imagine ourselves offering something to our idol, right? Not bad. I mean, in the Bible, the word idol referred to a thing, and that's what would happen. But here's the big issue. Ken Collier says, just two choices on the shelf, pleasing God or pleasing self. We can substitute a word and say just two choices on the shelf, worshiping God or worshiping self. Picture two altars. I can take my phone, which I won't because it's actually recording something right now. I can take my entertainment, my phone, my food, my relationships, my money. I can take anything and I can offer it as a sweet smelling aroma satisfaction to myself, or I can take that thing and I can offer it as a sacrifice to God. Gottman is wrong in his ideologies, even the ones that he gets right, because he's doing it for himself, because he believes this is best, because what he's trying to accomplish. Now, that's not to say that if we take this and we put it on the altar to God, that it all of a sudden becomes okay, because there's so much in here that's not going to be pleasing to him, and the whole foundation is idolatrous, and almost like it can't be put over here. God would reject it like the strange fire from the two guys whose names just escaped my mind. You know who I'm talking about in the Old Testament. Nadab and Abihu, thank you, yes. God is very particular about what's offered to him. There are some things that cannot be put on the altar to God. He'll reject it every single time like he rejected Cain's offering. So, but all of those things that can't be put over here can be put over here. And we love those things. So the first thing is emotion coaching is idolatrous. It's rooted in that. The second thing is it's reactionary. Basically, his entire preface starts off with, all of these bad things will happen to your kids if you don't learn how to be an emotion coach. My friends, that is a terrible motivation for anything, all right? What's funny about running from a tiger is if you're running from the tiger, you don't really know what you're running into. You could be running into another tiger. You could be running into a pit, a tree, a rock, who knows? Because you're so focused on what you're running from versus focusing on what you're running to. Gottman doesn't know what he's running to. He just believes that it's going to help him avoid these bad things, which are the impetus for what he's going to say is his model. But again, personal application time. How many times do we in our counseling come at it from a reactionary approach, where we're giving them the truths of God so that they can avoid the bad things in their lives, avoid the consequences? I grew up in the 80s and 90s where the vast majority of evangelism was, let's not go to hell. Don't get me wrong. Not going to hell is a great thing. But my friends, it's the icing on the cake. I'm not running in the general direction of Jesus because I don't want to go there. I need to be running there because that's where I need to be running. He is the God, King, creator of the universe. He deserves my love. He deserves my everything. And that's where I'm running. Now, yes, the Bible has a lot to say about hell, more to say about hell than it has to say about heaven. Obviously, right? It's a reality. It's a truth. But we need to be very careful that we're not setting out a motivation in front of people that is a reactionary motivation, because reactionary motivations are primarily idolatrous. I don't want to experience that. I don't want that to happen to me. I don't want whatever, and so I'm going to make these choices in order to avoid that. Instead, I work a lot with parents. Parents, like, I need to change my parenting so that my kids... Stop you right there. No. If your parenting is wrong, it needs to change so that you glorify God. Whether your kids submit to it or not doesn't matter. You owe that to God. If your parenting is right, don't change it because you're hoping your kids will respond to you better. Parents fall into that a lot, especially when they have terrorist teenagers. Well, if I stop talking to them about God, we argue less. So, okay, we're not supposed to be reactionary in how we approach truth. And Gottman does that. His whole system is based on it. It's also confused. It's very confused. I'll give you some basic examples of what I mean here. First of all, Gottman believes that behavior grows from emotion, not that it follows emotion like we saw in our biblical scientific description, but that it is like the Pixar idea of it is that everything grows from emotions. But emotions, as we've seen, it is not the genesis of our actions. What we do, say, and feel, okay, we do what we do, we say what we feel. Wow, get this right, Aaron. We do what we do, say what we say, and feel what we feel because we want what we want. And we want what we want because we believe what we believe about God, His Word, and ourselves. That's why we do what we do. There's truth, and everything grows up from there. So Gottman's wrong on that standpoint. He's confused about how that works. It's also interesting to note that Gottman never defines emotions. I read the first chapter, and I left myself a note at the bottom of the first chapter. It says this. Chapter 1 is over, and they haven't defined what emotions are. I predict they never will. And he never did. He never did because of all the discrepancies we talked about at the beginning. He can't define emotion. The more careful he thinks, the more specific he thinks about emotions, the more he'll realize that what he's saying doesn't really make sense or that it contradicts what other people are saying. He never defines it, an entire system based off of emotions, and he never once even tries to define what they are because he just assumes, I say sadness, you know what I'm talking about. If my child says they're angry, I know what they're talking about, and it's just, it's this okay thing. A lot of confusion, massively. Yeah, you got it? Okay, good. He also oversimplifies approaches, which we can also get, we oftentimes do that if we're not careful in biblical counseling. His examples of the motivations and actions, oftentimes of religious parents, I'll talk about this more later, are often exceptionally unfair caricatures. He's just overly confused about that. He also lumps positive character traits and methods in with clearly wrong behavior, thereby discrediting the biblical approaches. Oftentimes he'll mention some biblical approach. He doesn't mention it as being biblical, but it's actually a right approach. But then he'll couch it with a bunch of other bad things that people do who also sometimes tend to do this. And because they do these bad things, that this makes this thing wrong too. It's just illogical how he goes about it. He talks about this one person, Sophie, who was a religious mother. Gottman writes, constant self-denial often left her struggling against feelings of resentment and frustration. Okay, but self-denial is actually a good and godly thing. The feelings of resentment and frustration did not come because of her self-denial. It became of her self-worship. So there's a lot of that confusing, illogical, unbiblical talk in there. Gottman's conclusions are also very subjective. When it comes to talk about setting limits, Gottman illustrates various good and bad limits parents put on children. However, since none of the limits Gottman illustrates have any moral standing, and since they are all innately rooted in one's own personal setting of limits, the subjectivity causes the entire house of cards to collapse on itself because he acts as if the limits he suggests are right and good, but that anybody else's limits that disagree with his limits would be wrong for no reason more than the fact that he said that his limits were good. Again, internal inconsistencies. Obviously, the only limits we know that truly matter are the ones set by the creator of the universe. And yet, for all of his talk about the importance of setting limits, Gottman also says that we must, quote, ignore our parental agenda when problem solving. Well, the obvious issue with this is that our agenda should be God's agenda. Therefore, ignoring our agenda is a super bad idea. Because when it comes to problem solving, God's agenda is all that matters. It doesn't really matter that my child thinks that this way is best. What matters is what God says and how I help my child see that. Gottman discourages what he calls excessive criticism in the book, but then admits from his inability to define it that the idea of too much criticism is subjective. So he says we need to make sure that we're not being excessively critical of our children. And no doubt, you're wondering what that means. I don't know. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he says. I can't really tell you what too much is. It's just that too much is bad, so whatever too much is, don't do it. Well, thanks. We appreciate that. Thankfully, the scriptures give us a lot more helpful understanding of what truth and love is supposed to accomplish and how it's supposed to accomplish it. But then this is my favorite part. This is still under the emotion coaching is confusing. Gottman actually undercuts, he contradicts his own premise. One of the final sections of the book is a list of all the times, he has a chapter on it, all the times that emotion coaching doesn't work. Now, if I have a system and I like, it works in these times, but it doesn't work in that time, at best I'm thinking to myself, I probably need to find a better system. But he says, emotion coaching, there are times it just doesn't work. Don't use it. What's even funnier is that the areas in which it doesn't work is all shades of gray that, if applied the way a biblical person would apply it, would be the argument that would say the whole thing is not worth using. Give you a better example. We've already discussed his subjective approach to misbehavior, limits, and consequences. It's convoluted. It's dangerous. And this is a wonderful proof. He admits that emotion coaching doesn't actually work when serious misbehavior, which he defines-ish, right? But again, it's super subjective. When serious misbehavior has to be addressed. This not only contradicts much of his book and is a palatable reskinning of what he believes are detrimental parenting styles, but for the Christian, what happens when God says that our children's negative emotions, which Gottman says are fine and good, the Bible actually says are detrimental and serious? So if emotion coaching doesn't work all of the time when serious misbehavior is in play, and the serious misbehavior includes very wrong interpretations of the emotional experience, then the entire approach is not going to work, ever. But of course, he doesn't see that the same way. So anyway, the entire system just comes crashing down because the serious misbehavior that needs to be addressed, and which won't be solved with emotion coaching, is the behavior that Gottman actually encourages all throughout his book. It's the kind of behavior that emotion coaching allows at lower levels, but then is a problem when such ideologies are allowed to ferment. Let me give you an example of this. Our kid does something ridiculous when they're very small, and we take a picture of them and we laugh at it. But it's not culturally cute when we see our daughter taking money out of our purses and wallets, right? They got into their Halloween candy they weren't supposed to, and they're covered, and they're saying, "No, I didn't." And we're like, "Ha ha ha ha." But eventually that sin stops being cute. And it's that subjectivity, early on that Gottman would say, well, we need to understand what they were feeling in that moment. We need to validate and affirm and so on and so forth. But later on, he's not concerned about that because stealing is wrong. Like, oh, okay, good to know. That was something I did skip over earlier too. His big thing is the affirmation, the validation of emotion. There is a certain degree to which it is wise to say, I understand what you're feeling. I empathize with you. I sympathize with you. You are experiencing this pure emotion. And I even see how you're responding to it, how you're interpreting it. Okay, to acknowledge that is fine. Gottman crosses the line and says we also need to affirm that because you experienced that, it's okay. And that's not okay when the scriptures say that how you're interpreting and how you're behaving is inappropriate. Again, another crossed wire there. So truth is decent, it's orderly, it's logical, it's theological, it won't contradict itself, it won't be confused. And any system with internal consistencies isn't trustworthy, even when we have the inerrant, all-sufficient word of, when we have the inerrant, all-sufficient word of God, why bother? As I mentioned before, it is dishonest. He redefines and adds to these concepts about religious people or about certain things. He has a whole chapter on why spanking is just absolutely terrible. But then he doesn't really describe how God would have us use corporal punishment and for the reasons he would have us do it. He just caricatures it the entire time. He also Gottman believes in the beneficial evolutionary development of humanity. He argues that this belief should motivate our parenting. Emotion coaching should be used because it's part of us evolving as a people. Again, a dishonest, inaccurate way of looking at life. Thankfully, we know that God is the way, the truth, and the life. And the truth sets us free to flourish as he created us to flourish. So lastly, really the big issue is that emotion coaching is destructive. Gottman believes that no emotion is ever inappropriate. But when God says that we shouldn't feel something, to experience that emotion is always going to be destructive. Gottman puts a huge emphasis on the importance of validating another's emotions. It's not enough for him, for the parent or spouse or counselor to factually acknowledge the experience. They must also communicate that it's okay to have the emotional experience. Unfortunately for Gottman, the Bible teaches that experiencing and encouraging anything that God condemns will only lead to destruction. Gottman also defines the enemy as whoever holds a differing opinion from your child. He tells parents, don't side with the enemy. And he wants us to not side with them. But we know that children are foolish and sinful. Many, if not most, of the things against which children fight are righteousness and truth. Siding along with our children against truth enslaves, it kills, it destroys. If our children are being an enemy of God, we need to side with God. In regard to allowing children to make their own decisions, Gottman admits that he would allow kids to make choices that he thinks are not good, though not dangerous, as defined by his belief system, but by a biblical belief system would be very dangerous. However, a number of the decisions he allows, the Bible condemns. Idolatry is an abomination. Self-preservation is destructive. And I say self-preservation from a not like, you know, don't fall off the bridge, but in all the wicked things that we do. Misunderstanding is a symptom of a hard heart. Lies are the darkness of spiritual blindness, and the wages of sin is death. All of those things are destructive. As my mother always said during math class, when I would incorrectly copy a problem onto my paper, you will never come to the right answer if you start with the wrong numbers. And that's exactly what emotion coaching is doing. It's all the wrong numbers that will cause more problems than it will solve. So I assume none of you would have ever picked up a copy of that and be like, I want to understand what he's talking about emotional intelligence and so on and so forth, and let's try to work this into my counseling. I hope you have a better understanding and clearer reckoning of some of the five big issues with his work. But I also hope that you've been challenged and encouraged, not only in having a more doctrinal understanding of what emotions really are, why God created them, how they exist, how we interact with them in our lives, but then also, too, not to fall into the same traps in our counseling that underlie exactly what Gottman is doing. We can't allow these things to slip into our own counseling. And these later things will always come when it starts here. I will always misrepresent things. I will always be confused. I'll always be reactionary. I'll always be destructive when I'm leading people from the wrong motivation, that motivation being anything other than God and his glory. So with that, that's the end of the material. We have a couple minutes to go here, and then I have some time afterward. I know I sped through that again. I said overprepared. A lot of information at you guys. Give yourself a second to kind of think through, maybe frame a question if you have one. And I'd love to jump into it. If it's really specific about parenting, I'm fine with that too. If it's broader, that's also okay. So what are your thoughts? What are some things that you've encountered as you had very emotional counselees? Yes, sir.
I don't even know if this is related, so you can help me with it. But for example, what Ken Sandy's doing with emotional intelligence, are these two different categories? Or are you familiar with what he's been doing with that?
So I'm familiar. Ken Sandy is the known for the peacemaking, right?
I was doing the 360. I forgot it.
So I can't say that I know that Ken Sandy is using the terminology emotional intelligence. I will say that I choose not to do that because the Bible has far better words to use to describe what's wrong with us than co-opting words that were created from secular concepts. Emotional intelligence has ideas packed into it that are unbiblical, though it has very right things in it involved in it. Gentleman and I were talking earlier. Emotional intelligence is basically I'm able to look at a person and to be able to, I'm able to accurately tell what I'm feeling as well as other people. Well, those are biblical concepts. That's not bad. We should be able to do that. We can't weep with those who weep if we don't know they're weeping, right? But when you co-opt that word and we try to redeem it and sanctify it and say that, you know, we need to teach our kids to be emotionally intelligent, we run the risk of people going to Google to learn more about it and learning all the bad stuff about it that shouldn't be used. But then also, too, the people who know about it, assuming that we're espousing the concepts that were designed by these human beings. In his preface, he goes into a lot of detail about where the idea of emotional intelligence came from. Did not come from a good foundation. So it's very possible that everything Sandy is saying has value biblically. He's just using terminology I would prefer not to use.
Not that this is what we're here for, but
sure.
He started out with the peacemaker saying, I'm trying to do all this conflict resolution. And he said, you know what if I moved upstream and said, let's learn how not to have conflict by being more aware of, making ourselves aware not just of our own situation, but God's, you know, an awareness of God's role in this, an awareness of the other person's perception of what's happening.
And being observant and discerning and wise, super important.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't see anything, you know, just overtly. I just wasn't sure, you know, if these things overlap somehow.
There are different camps in biblical counseling. Integrationists, in particular, obviously use all the secular terminology, but there are biblical CCEF is a perfect example. They embrace more of those secular terms, though they're generally not talking about them the same way that the secularists are talking about them. I personally find there's danger in that. So, other questions, thoughts, experiences you've had with emotional individuals?
Yes. I was going to say, how much do you meet people where they're at if they're using some of this terminology versus slowly guiding them along, and then maybe it's not the most important thing to correct their vocabulary versus it kind of is critical because it affects how they're thinking?
I believe that a lot of Jesus's parables were designed to be a reset. When you have an example, when I slammed on the table, it all kind of brought us to the same experience. When he starts talking about planting a seed, we're all like, yeah. So oftentimes what I do is I will, without putting it up on a board or something like that, I'll just talk with them through. By the way, it's after two. If you need to go, please feel free. I will talk with them through. Okay, let's walk through why you're experiencing what you're experiencing. What happened? Tell me what happened. I say things like, how did that make you feel, right? What did you feel because of that? And oftentimes when they start to describe, they may be describing how they felt physically. I had butterflies or I felt whatever. Sometimes they start to describe more their interpretation of it. And I'll just try to separate those out. Let's focus on physically, how did you feel? Okay. And then I invite them to explain their perception. I'll use different terms or whatever, but they'll describe how they interpreted it basically. And then I'll try to step them through, okay, well, I did this with a young man once. Mark Massey, who I worked with at Victory Academy, had lost his father. And this young man had lost his father. And this young man didn't understand how Mark seemed so at peace, even though Mark's dad was unsaved and is burning in hell today. This other man's father was born again, according to his professions, in heaven. This man is like, boom. But Mark had peace. And I said, okay, so you both had a similar experience. You could argue that Mark's experience was worse. And yet he interprets his experience differently than you do. Do you see that? So instead of sitting down with somebody like that and trying to lecture them and trying to teach them new vocabulary, I try to go to a reset position. Let's walk through this and talk about it logically. Because one of my favorite things to say is, if your philosophy of life does not work 100% of the time, you need a new philosophy. When I was interacting with the gentleman from last night, he was saying, blank you, blank you, blank you, walk away, walk away, walk away. And I was like, well, I could tell you the same thing. No, you walk away. Who makes you the decision maker here? Do you get to say it? Why don't I get to say it? You get to yell at her because you think that she did something terrible to you. She shouldn't have done something terrible to you. But honestly, you've done something pretty terrible to me. What do I get to do to you? And just talking through the inconsistencies in their own system oftentimes is all that it takes to at least get them to realize that, whether they omit it or not, that those inconsistencies are a linchpin problem. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
I find that's a lot more helpful. We are hypocritical individuals. We are self-worshippers. We don't make sense. Sin is the very definition of insanity. We're delusional, we're blind, we are insane. The Bible says we're senseless. The Bible actually uses lots of terminology that compares us to zombies, consuming our own flesh and the flesh of other people. That's what sin is. When you shine God's truth onto it in simple, easy to digest steps and lead people through those stages, they see it. They don't always understand it, hard hearts and whatever, but they do start to see it, that if nothing else, their system is broken. I had an atheist young man who came to live with us, and I said to him, dude, life is terrible for you. Like, you always hate life. All of us professing Christians, regardless of all the junk you guys bring into our lives, we're at peace and we're joyful. I said, just look at this from a scientific experiment. Seriously. Like, look at life and look at your experiences and what you're feeling and so on and so forth, and look at us, and then ask yourself, why is yours broken? because you can't have the same joy we have, even though you think you should be able to have it. And that months later, even though he left atheistic, hating God, he did say to me, "You're right. Like, you'd think I'd be happier if I were right." And I was like, "Yeah, you think you would." So I encourage that. Again, if you need to leave, feel free to leave. If you have more questions, feel free to ask. Don't forget, you can get my information from that little card on the table. Just hold your phone up to it or take a picture of the QR code, and you can get that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I hope that the resources on the app are also valuable for you guys. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it.
You're listening to a resource from the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to promote excellence in biblical counseling. For more resources or to find out more information about ACBC, please visit us at biblicalcounseling.com.